The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court.
Unless there is any more question, we have to find an argument in this case.
All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to give their attention.
Welcome to Divided Argument, an unscheduled, unpredictable Supreme Court podcast. I'm Dan Epps.
And I'm Will Bode. It's our first non-live show of the season.
Yes, this is season three. Can you believe we're in our third season?
Feels like forever to me.
Yeah. I don't know if that's a...
It's a good thing.
Yeah, it's not even really three full seasons because we started season one kind of in the middle of the term. This is our second full season. We'll know if it's a full season if we make it through the whole... But in theory, second full season. It's good to be back in the studio after a great trip to Colonial Williamsburg. I think you have to call it Colonial Williamsburg, as I've said. And we're, you know, less of a gap when it's just a couple weeks, right?
Yeah.
Not the whatever 5 or 6 week gap that we had last time.
Summer's over, my friend.
Yeah, we're back. First Monday in October is Monday. We are recording this on Friday, September 30th. So hopefully this will get to you sometime over the weekend. So a lot going on. We are going to jump back in. I'm still getting my head back into the court. I've like had a couple like reporters ask me stuff about the term and I'm like, I don't even remember. You know, it's like I get like this stuff totally leaves my brain for like a blissful month or two, you know, right around August. And then I have to get sucked back in, you know, check them out. They pull me back in.
I'm sorry to say the Supreme Court never leaves my brain.
I mean, the Supreme Court like is your brain.
I wish. Okay. So I've gotten a lot of feedback, not all of it friendly, from our conversation on friendly disagreement at Williamsburg. I don't know about you.
Not as much. Can I just flag one trivial one? And then you can, I'm sure you've got substantive ones. Because I wasn't sure what to make of this one. This is a bad review on the Apple podcast store. It says, this is my first time listening to the show and I might have to stop after about 10 minutes. One guy's mic is perfect with crisp audio. The other guy sounds like he's in a hole and mumbles and trails off in every sentence. He's not even speaking human language. He sounds more like a punctured tire that's given up on life. He speaks two words and whisper mumbles 10, rinse and repeat. And so I first read that and I thought, this is about Will and the bad audio episode, but I'm not sure because I feel like I do more like trailing off than you do.
I hope that's about me. Now, we're both mumblers, unfortunately.
Yeah, maybe it's so.
Weird that two mumblers can survive on a podcast together.
Yeah. Well, I guess we have lost listener Selp. Selp is not on the team. And so we'll have to persist without Selp Selp's enjoyment of the show. But you had some more substantive stuff. Bring it on.
I'll just say, you know, obviously a lot of people were horrified by the suggestion I made that we could still do the show, even if you were part of the Maoist takeover.
Yeah, that's an insane position. Your position on this is insane.
Including several of my actual friends. So I'm not going to relitigate
that. Unlike me, is that what you're saying?
No. We're friends too, I hope.
Yeah, the way you said that, well, my actual friends.
Well, I just mean not just, you know, people who listen
to the show. Not randos.
Not just friends.
Self.
Not just friends, not even just friends of the show, friends of non-show, Will.
Friends of you.
I do think we totally collapsed for lots of reasons, things like collegiality with things like friendship. I just want to know if there's like actually a huge span of like being friends with somebody and then like being able to like participate in an activity collegially. And I think we, being actual friends, like covered a whole range of that. And that's actually a much more complicated network. One of my students who listens to the show complained that Aristotle, in fact, distinguishes between a number of different kind of friend relationships, like friendships of convenience and friendships of virtue and friendships of pleasure. And that, you know, so even there, we could get into a lot of different gradations. So I just want to say, I probably oversimplified a lot of that stuff.
Well, there's only so much you can do on the fly. Can I just say one overarching thought I had coming out of that?
Yeah.
Which is that I totally see, like, I think that you're coming from this as a place of, like, you're seeing, and I agree with you about a lot of this stuff, there's way too much eagerness to cancel people or to, like, not platform people or just refuse to hear arguments, like, all sorts of stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I feel like you have taken that, like, your reaction has just been to go all the way to the other extreme and basically say, like, it is never, ever appropriate to declare something out of bounds.
Yeah.
That just strikes me as, it just seems like there should be some limits on, like, polite society somewhere. We don't have to have the whole conversation again, but it just seems like there should, the fact that maybe where society or where certain segments of society wants to draw that line is way too soon. Yeah. I still think, like, you know, like, I don't want to have to be cordial to someone who's espousing Nazi race hatred. You know, I don't want to be on the stage with that person. I don't want to talk to that person.
I'll say this. I try very hard to say what I actually think on this podcast and all the, like, weird stuff I say. I try very hard for that all to be genuine, but you're probably right about my psychology. You're probably right.
Well, I'm not saying you don't believe it. I'm just saying that, like, maybe
you're probably right. I'm reacting to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're probably right about that. So the one other thing is we talked a lot about this Yeshiva University case at the court, where that Yeshiva sort of lost and was sent back to the lower courts to try to figure out, you know, the dark arts of New York appellate procedure. And I just wanted to flag a couple of developments, as I understand it. This is still sort of unfolding. For all I know, it'll be folded again by the time that stuff comes out. But as I understand it, Yeshiva University's initial response to losing was to cancel all of the student clubs entirely. We sort of talked about some of these reactions, like under the theory, well, that's equal treatment, right? If just no clubs can do anything while we go sort of try to negotiate the stay process. And then, as I understand it, this is not reflected on an official docket that I can find, but as I understand it, then the student group then volunteered to not seek recognition right now, sort of like consented to a stay if Yeshiva would let the other student groups come back because they didn't want to be, they're all students. Well, and they didn't want to be in the position of having all their fellow students kind of suffering because of the hard line Yeshiva was taking against them. So I think there's kind of a negotiated ceasefire in a way. While this can now go through the state court process, maybe that's ill-informed, maybe something else will happen, but I think that's where the case kind of rests, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah. But as the ceasefire, but not the end of hostilities.
Not a truce, not a treaty.
So we will expect a decent chance that will return. What else? Justice Jackson had her formal investiture.
Mm-hmm.
She's now, like, she already was a justice, but now she's, like, really, really.
Well, that has no legal effect, right? That's
no,
just,
I know. It's just kind of a ceremony.
I like ceremony. I got married. I mean,
you didn't join the Supreme Court bar, though. That's a ceremony.
Well, it's partly because I want the ceremony, and then you want me to do it in the mail, and then it all.
We didn't get press invites to this event. We still don't have. We're not hard pass holders, but maybe if we just keep doing enough of these episodes, we will. I want to get on the. I don't think we're even on the, like, public information office, like, email distribution list. I don't even know if they'll let us do that. But if they're listening, please do. Related to that, we had a not super consequential order, but one that happens every time there's a new justice who joins the court. Which is that, you see this, Will, we have a new shuffling of, not really much of a shuffling, but
yeah, no shuffle.
Circuit justices. So Justice Breyer was the circuit justice for the First Circuit, and now Justice Jackson will take that spot. Circuit justice is like, it's hard to describe what this is to people who don't totally know. It's like you're the like godfather of that Federal Circuit Court.
I think of it as more like the regional manager.
Yeah. You have limited authority. You get to go to their, like, fancy judicial conference and, like, they kind of get to claim you. And then the real substantive thing that matters is that you are then the person in charge handling requests for various kinds of shadow docket type things that come up from that circuit. So, like, if you're a potential petitioner seeking Supreme Court review in the First Circuit and you need, like, an extra 30 days, you would go to Justice Jackson now.
And this used to be very more important because I think Justice Scalia had a very idiosyncratic, stingy view of when you should get extra time, and he had the Fifth Circuit. So Supreme Court practitioners in the Fifth Circuit just had, like, 3 months less to work on their cases than anybody else did because Justice Scalia wouldn't give them time.
I mean, my sense is that there's still some variation. I think that, like, when I was there, it was kind of funny because Justice Stevens would give anybody however much time they wanted, just automatically. You want 60 days, you get 60 days. Justice Scalia would, like, give, like, nobody time unless they had, like, you know, like, eight of the attorneys on this case have died, and it would give you, like, 15 days or something. Very, very stingy. And then Justice Kennedy would usually kind of split the difference.
Like, give you half the time you asked for, or?
Yeah, often, like, people would, like, request 60 days and he would give them 30. Like, kind of just maps on to their judicial approaches.
Yeah.
Honestly, I thought that was pretty reasonable of him. But maybe there's something wrong with just automatically giving them all the time. There's something wrong with being so stingy and, like, maybe just being reasonable is actually the right way to do it.
When your students want extensions, do you grant them or do you split the difference?
It depends. It depends on the circumstances. I don't do that many. I mostly do like exam based classes, so it doesn't come up. But but I mean, people have to give reasons, right? You know, you're supposed to give a reason at least in your motion for extension of time, and
usually, but again, some people want
sometimes they're being used strategically too to like push the case off of a particular conference. You know, you and I just had a little bit of an exchange about this the other day because you sent me like this kind of older piece by John Elwood about like looking at grants over the summer and the long conference and like which distributions they came from, and then trying to game out whether it mattered, whether the newly hired clerks or the outgoing clerks like reviewed a petition, which is kind of interesting. And so some savvy lawyers might use extensions to try to push the case beyond a certain conference to get the new clerks or get the,
or sometimes you want to push it to like a new presidential administration. Like if you think like you want the SG to intervene, and maybe if we can, you know, that doesn't happen all the time, but I think the one other thing that circuit justices do is, as I understand it, maybe this is just customary, when the court appoints an amicus to defend the judgment below, like in these weird cases where the lower court does something that no party wants to defend, it seems to be the custom that that person is picked by the circuit justice of the circuit. So the 11th Circuit people get picked by Justice Thomas, and the 6th Circuit people get picked by Justice Kagan. To the extent they have different.
Yes. And they're often picking former clerks.
Right. And often their own former clerks. So I think if you.
Yes. Yeah.
If you're a former Justice Jackson clerk really trying to get your first argument, like now is the time to move to Massachusetts, I think.
But you don't have to be.
Oh, I guess that's right.
I guess the case, you have to just get involved in a case coming out of that circuit somehow.
Well, you don't want to be too involved.
No, you can't be involved. Yeah, you can't be involved in that.
Just develop expertise in the first circuit cases.
You have no role in that case.
Yeah, okay. Never mind.
I think Kate Shaw had an article about this, looking at the practices of these appointments over the years and how many of them really are these kind of like, I mean, basically, you know, kind of handouts to
patronage appointments.
To former. I was trying to decide if patronage was the right word there, but I think it works. Former clerks, have you ever gotten one of these?
Been invited by the court to argue as clerks? Yeah. No, I would have talked about it.
You're the kind of person who's going to be.
I would be flattered. I would set aside all my work. And
also, you have a really good chance because the Chief Justice is the Circuit Justice for 3 circuits.
That's true.
But DC, I'm not sure. Federal Circuit and Fourth Circuit.
I don't think he likes me that much.
You've said nothing but good things about him on the show.
I try.
If he's listening.
I try. Yeah, I think actually the Chief Justice got his first argument this way, is my memory, is that his very first argument was as an appointment in a sort of pro bono criminal procedure case.
That was before he went to the SG's office. We just took a break for Will to do some research, and it turns out that the thing he said was right, that John Roberts was, his first argument was an appointment in a case called, was it United States versus Halper?
That's right. A sort of complicated double jeopardy case. Double jeopardy, False Claims Act, Medicare against Michael Dreeben.
Michael Dreeben got in trouble for the False Claims Act?
No, he is the one who got people in trouble. His specialty was getting
people. He was the lawyer, so it wasn't like a case against him. So I'm not going to get one of those because the justice I clerked for has now left the court. So I'm not holding my breath on one of those. Sometimes they go to like random law professors.
Yeah.
But they're usually like people who teach at Harvard. But I do a good job, I think. Sometimes people don't do, like, I've heard stories about people, like, who are professors getting these, and then they, like, don't make the best arguments because they don't agree with them. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, you know, your job isn't to just, like, make your own theory. Your job is actually to make the most persuasive arguments for the court, I think, in that role.
I think it is a weird role, since you're an amicus, but your client is the judgment. Is that, like, a real attorney-client relationship where you try to figure, zealously represent the judgment, or is that...
Your client is yourself, but you're... You are yourself, you know, you are the amicus, and like the person, the name on the brief, and not just the name and the caption of the brief and the lawyer name is you, right? But you've been told to argue in support of the judgment below. So you have to make the best arguments in support of the judgment below, right?
Yes. Yes. No, I agree. I would do that.
Okay. So what else? Jenny Thomas testified before the January 6th commission, Justice Thomas's wife. And I think the testimony as such is not currently public, but it was a 5-hour closed door session. And we've heard some snippets have come out. It doesn't seem great. I think she said something along the lines of asserting that the 2020 election was fraudulent. So continues to believe that, which is, it's not great. It does not inspire confidence in our system that, regardless of what you think, you know, like, you shouldn't necessarily ascribe people's views to their spouses. It just, I don't feel great about the fact that one of our justices seems to be married to somebody who's kind of a crackpot. It's not great.
I mean, I agree, although I think the number of crackpots in the country is not great. I wish this were a rarer.
I guess I would like that the people in the upper echelons of the halls of power, sorry, it's a mixed metaphor or something, would be less likely to be surrounded by the crackpots. Yeah.
According to the various, you know, we don't know if these sources are accurate, but the sources seem to say she read some sort of opening statement to the committee that was a kind of flat statement that her husband has never spoken to her about pending cases at the court. It's an ironclad rule in her house, and she doesn't talk about her political work much to him because he doesn't care about politics, and she's never practiced law. And they, as I understand the statement, the law politics divide is strictly observed in the Thomas household, with Justice Thomas on the law side and Jenny Thomas on the politics side. I don't know if anybody believes that anymore. They believe in the law politics divide, you know, ever, yeah. But that's their story.
Yeah. That strikes me. Yeah. I don't know what to say about that.
We have no knowledge of how the Thomas
I would like to read a transcript, or, you know, and I don't think we'll ever, I guess we won't ever get it like a recording, but we maybe at some point we'll get a transcript.
Yeah.
Okay. Other spicy, contentious Supreme Court stuff going on. Justice Alito.
Talk to the Wall Street Journal?
Yeah. Shot back at the critics who are questioning the Supreme Court's legitimacy. And what did he say? Do you have that? So
Justice
right
Alito said, it goes without saying that everyone is free to express disagreement with our decisions and to criticize our reasoning as they see fit. But saying or implying that the court is becoming an illegitimate institution or questioning our integrity crosses an important line. What I can't figure out, this was apparently a statement to the Wall Street Journal. I can't figure out what question he was asked to produce this statement.
Yeah.
So this is being put in all the news stories as sort of in response to Justice Kagan suggesting that the court is losing its legitimacy and Justice Roberts saying that it shouldn't lose its legitimacy. And then this is, so I can't tell if he's talking back to Justice Kagan to the Wall Street Journal or whether he was just asked some question about, like, do you have a comment about the Supreme Court's legitimacy? And he decided to say this, in which case it's kind of anodyne.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's anodyne under any of those. But, like, who is crossing the line, I guess, is the question. Does he think, like, just all people cross the line when they question the court's legitimacy? Because strikes me as both, you know, wrong and
I think it's
dangerous.
Right that there's a line. I think it's one thing to disagree with the decisions, and it's like it crosses a line. Now, whether it's good or bad to cross the line, like, there are two kinds of critique. There's the legitimacy critique and the your decisions are wrong critique. And there is an important line between them. That's the part that seems anodyne. Now, I think it's implied that, like, if you're on the question the legitimacy side of the line, that's the bad side of the line that you shouldn't be on. But I don't think the statement, I mean, maybe that's obvious, but.
It sounds sort of threatening, though. It's like, well, you got a right to do this, but if you do that, you cross an important line.
It's the vague kind of threatening, right? It's not like is unacceptable or is intolerable, or it's just like you crossed a line. I mean, I think, like, you'd say this to Sam Moyne, he'd be like, you're damn right I crossed the line. I'm trying to cross the line.
Yeah, it's pretty striking, though, right?
The genre is the more striking. Like, it's just weird. Like, the justices don't usually comment on this kind of crap. So that he bothered to comment at all to the Wall Street Journal is striking, I think.
Yeah, and I'm not super comfortable with the justices kind of like hitting back at critics like this. It also like it feels like an argument that you lose by participating in it.
Yes.
Well, if you start like getting in the media and being like, no, we really are legitimate. It's like,
so I apologize to the chief, but do you remember during the Trump era when Trump started complaining about a district judge in the Southern District of California who was assigned to, I think, one of his cases about the wall or something, and he called him an Obama judge, and then the chief justice, you know, answered a comment from a reporter saying, you know, we have no Bush judges and no Obama judges. We're all just judges.
Yep.
That was an example. Like, normally the justices don't do that. And then, you know, Trump immediately started tweeting at the chief, and it wasn't clear that.
That was not self-defeating, though. I thought that was a good comment by the chief. Mm. You thought that was self-defeating?
Well, I think this is the same. So maybe you just think comments by Alito are bad and comments by the chief.
No, I don't think that's right. I think so. First of all, like, lots of things to say about that. I mean, so one, they're, you know, you had a conservative justice sort of like implicitly criticizing a Republican president, sort of counterpartisan. He's defending Democratic judge, and he's saying like very anodyne stuff. Whereas like the Alito thing is a conservative judge defending his own turf from liberal critics and people in the political sphere, and he's doing so in kind of like a menacing way. I don't know. I feel like the public reaction to Roberts was not as controversial as that to this.
Well, everybody likes Roberts more than Alito. Yeah, maybe that's the similarity. Is like Supreme Court justice says Supreme Court is not political in response to politician. It's sort of one of those conversations that's hard to win. Yeah. In the same way that like Justice Alito says Supreme Court is legitimate in response to people who say Supreme Court is illegitimate. It's one of those like, of course you'd say that, and what? How does that help us?
Yeah, he has a beard now.
Sorry,
these remarks he gave earlier in the summer, where he was like making fun of foreign leaders who had criticized his Dobbs decision.
Very briefly. Saying,
yeah, and saying that Boris Johnson lost because, you know, he criticized. I mean, it was actually funny, but it was a little bit, you know, a little bit unusual, maybe crossing an important line. And he had a beard during those remarks. And I don't know, is he like a beard guy now?
Maybe it's a pandemic beard.
Well, it's kind of like, I did what I wanted. I came here to do, like, I, you know, overturned Roe, and now it's like beard time. Like, you know, it's let loose. Yeah. Alito unleashed, which is quite scary to me.
There was that Scalia beard for a year or two.
Yeah. I don't know what that was about either. Okay. So should we talk about some stuff that's like a case?
Yeah. You want to talk about?
Offer some expertise. So we got this pork case.
Yeah.
Which I was only dimly aware of until you told me that we should talk about it yesterday. And now I'm aware of it and have read some stuff.
If you judge Supreme Court cases by the number of times they've been discussed at the University of Chicago roundtable, where we have lunch, this would be the most important Supreme Court case of the term and maybe of the past like several years.
Well, this one is of very high interest to academics. So this case is called National Pork Producers Council versus Ross. Mm-hmm. National Pork Producers Council is like an industry trade group for the folks who produce pork, as the name might suggest. And I've learned a bit more about the pork industry than I really wanted to. I'm probably not going to eat pork for a little bit after this. This is super interesting, and I have like no handle on what the answer should be here, like what even the right analytical structure. And I think like nobody does, as far as I can tell, from reading the briefs. And so what's going on here is state of California, our biggest, most populous state. It's most populous. Is it the biggest by landmass?
Alaska.
Oh, Alaska. Right. Alaska's the biggest, but California, our most populous state, by citizen initiative, passed something called Proposition 12. And Proposition 12, it's kind of like, you know, designed to be like an anti-animal cruelty bill. And what it does is, I think it imposes some rules that govern like raising pigs in the state of California. But apparently there's just like very few. That's just not a thing that people do in California for whatever reason. It's not pig central, but almost all pork production happens elsewhere. So it also has this requirement about pork sold in California. So it makes it a crime and a civil violation to sell pork in California unless the pig that it is, the former pig, was born to a sow. Is that what we say? Sow?
I think so.
Female pig, adult female pig, housed with 24 square feet of space in an enclosure that let her turn around without touching the enclosure. So this is, as I understand it, this is aimed at sort of eliminating these kind of like, what's the word for them? The kind of like...
Factory farms.
No, not factory, but for the thing. It's like breeding pens or like birthing cages. I forget the word. It's in the brief somewhere. And... okay, that's California. California can, like, normally states can say what you can sell there and not. But this is actually kind of a big deal, and it's a big deal outside of California. So why is that?
why is it a big deal outside of California?
Yeah, we're still setting the stage.
Yeah, so all the pigs come from, you know, Iowa or places like that where they don't have the same restrictions, right? And so if this law passes, given that California is like one of the major parts of the market, and given that
like passes constitutional muster.
Yeah, if it can be upheld, and given that pigs are also sold in parts, it practically would be very hard for other states to avoid complying with this law.
Well, that's the argument.
Right.
That's the argument. That's actually disputed in this case. But the argument of the pork producers is like, this is going to, like, some people might have heard the phrase, the California effect, which is like, if California, our most populous state, regulates some product in X way, then the rest of the country will kind of have to follow suit because it's too complicated to make California-specific products and not for the other states. And the argument is, look, if now this was going to change the pork industry all over the country and, you know, going to have all these economic consequences.
Yes.
And so people are mad about that. Some people, the pork producers, are mad.
But the legal question is whether California has the power to regulate pork sold in California, right?
Well, that's one way to phrase it. Another way that the petitioners here, the pork crew, want to phrase it is, does California have the power to regulate pork production outside the state of California?
Right, because they're regulating the sale of pork in California, but based on how it was produced outside of California. So this is one of these like great law professor hypos of, right, if you think California can't regulate the production of pork in Iowa, that's like not their business. And we can get back to whether that's actually true, but if we assume that, but California can regulate what's sold in California, then how do you draw the line between a regulation of Iowa farming versus a regulation of California sales, right?
Yeah. And the reason why this might be a problem is the so-called dormant commerce clause, sometimes like called the negative commerce clause, phrases.
That clause is not in my constitution, Dan. Is it in yours?
It's maybe like a bracketed kind of footnote. And so the idea being that the Constitution gives Congress the power to regulate interstate commerce. And so by implication, states lack that power.
Right.
And the states can't do anything that like interferes with interstate commerce. And, you know, there are some, I think, some pretty clear examples of things that people, you know, traditionally have thought to be covered by this. Like, states just can't like set up on the border and be like, you have to pay a tariff anytime to like bring certain kinds of products through our state, through New Jersey on the way to New York. That's probably not okay, right?
Yes, although it's not clear you need the Dormant Commerce Clause to tell you that's not okay. So this one of the things that's controversial, right? There are several justices in the court, at least Justice Thomas, maybe Justice Gorsuch, who don't believe in this whole thing. And one thing they would say is there are a bunch of other clauses of the Constitution, like a ban on imports and export, that states can't have duties on imports and exports, and states have to respect the privileges or immunities of citizens of other states, that if we took those seriously, would take care of a lot of these hypos. That's not the way the doctrine has progressed. The doctrine has put these under the Commerce Clause, you know, for 200 years. So we don't really have a fully worked out, like, alt history doctrine for how those things would work.
Yeah.
The other thing that's weird about this idea is that when the Commerce Clause was limited to commerce between the states, it kind of makes sense to think like, oh, there's like a negative version, right? There's a part of commerce that Congress can regulate. The other part is for the states. And like whatever that line is, like one part goes to Congress, one part goes to the states. Now, Congress's power over interstate commerce has been expanded to include almost everything, right? Almost everything Congress does is
involving like money or
involving wheat, involving any federal criminal law. The ban on possession of guns near schools is based on the Commerce Clause out of the theory that if the gun was
that's not upheld, though.
Well, Congress amended the statute after Lopez
to add a hook.
If the gun once traveled in interstate commerce, the Congress can regulate it. If that's the theory, then a strong negative commerce clause would say, well, states can't regulate any gun that ever passed in interstate commerce because Congress can. So we now don't really have this like idea of like Congress's power implies a negative to the state power.
Yeah, that there must be some, either one of those two things are wrong, or there must be some overlapping sphere of authority.
Right. But we still have some sense that like, there is also a lot of doctrine with the Dormant Commerce Clause and limits of what states can do to interstate commerce. And then the doctrine's already kind of messy, you know, famously people complain about it a lot. And then the messiest prong of the doctrine, easiest prong of the doctrine, is where the state sort of like explicitly discriminates against out-of-state commerce, you know, sets up the border and says no foreign commerce. there's a sort of messier prong where there's like a balancing test where they don't formally do that, try to figure out if they're doing it. And that's one of the arguments in the case. But the messiest prong is like three cases where the court has specifically said that laws that effectively regulate extraterritorially violate the Dormer Commerce Clause. But what that means and like, you know, how we draw the line between what counts as extraterritorial is weird, and why the Dormer Commerce Clause cares about extraterritoriality is weird. So this is sort of like, this is actually one of these great cases for the court to take because they could actually clear up a ton of confused Dormer Commerce Clause doctrine.
Yeah. And so the folks who would just jettison this, so Thomas would definitely just jettison this.
Yeah.
Gorsuch, same or a little bit more?
I believe he would also jettison it. He joined one of Justice Thomas's opinions in Tennessee Wine and Spirits versus Thomas. He wrote the dissent. So it's complicated because it's an alcohol case and alcohol has some of its own special rules.
21st Amendment.
Right? Yeah. So I believe that puts him in the skeptical category, but I haven't gone through to sort of carefully figure out whether it's, you know, only for alcohol or so. We could put them both in the skeptical category.
And then maybe a little bit less information about some of the other newer conservatives.
Right.
My sense is that Chief Justice Roberts like believes this is a thing.
I think he's applied it.
Yeah.
And I think since Kavanaugh and Barrett joined the court, I don't think there's been a major Dormant Commerce Clause case, given their more moderate views on precedent and on other kind of non-textual doctrines. I don't know. Yeah, you could imagine different possibilities.
Probably not going to get rid of this whole thing in this case, but might clarify it, limit it. I could say I don't really know what to make of all of this. I think maybe I'll start with the bottom line. I think that the law should probably be upheld. That's where I land. Where do you land on this? But then we can try to like reason backwards. Oh,
boy. I don't even know if I know.
Not even there.
I'm gonna go with probably the law should be upheld.
This one is kind of interesting because I think there are some ideological stakes in Dormant Commerce Clause cases. It does seem like at least the conservatives are more skeptical, but maybe that's just methodological. This one, I'm not totally clear what the ideological stakes are of this case. I think it could produce some weird, strange bedfellows, right? What were you going to say?
I take it the first level political analysis is like industry and big business is on the petitioner's side and liberal regulation is on California's side.
So I chose the side I was supposed to choose.
Yes. You chose. But then with the exception that Justice Thomas, this is one of the cases where Justice Thomas bends around the end because he doesn't believe in the doctrine. And I think like that's of the Dormant Commerce Clause challenges brought in the real world. I think a huge number of them are brought by businesses and industry.
Yeah.
So I think sort of like federal preemption in that sense, it's an area where.
Yeah. The thing I really want is free travel for alcohol.
Yeah.
And then I know we've got the 21st Amendment stuff to deal with there too, but like, you know, I should be able to order booze from anywhere in the country.
Yeah.
Be able to come in the mail, no restrictions. So.
Well, you got Granholm versus Heald.
Yeah. That helped. I think it didn't like get all the way to the world I want.
My dad used to litigate those cases.
Oh, really? Because he was a big wine guy.
He's a big wine guy in Indiana, which does not have a big wine industry. But worse, it has a small wine industry. So it has a lot of law designed to stop you from ordering wine to California to force you to instead drink Indiana wine.
Which is probably really bad.
And he argued one of the cases in the Seventh Circuit, and then he was the plaintiff in another one of the Seventh Circuit cases. Awesome. That actually the cert petition in that case was filed the year I was clerking. So, I had all these, co-clerks who were like, Bode v. Heath, that's a funny coincidence, what do you think? And I was like, oh, I really cannot talk about this case. I am as recused from this case as, as possible to be.
What was the outcome?
So basically in Granholm, the first Supreme Court case, the Supreme Court said states can't have discriminatory laws against alcohol, right? If you let the Indiana wineries ship people wine, you have to let the California wineries ship people wine. So after that, Indiana did a bunch of clever workarounds, one of which was upheld by the Seventh Circuit and one of which was struck down. So one of their clever workarounds was to say, you can't ship wine to Indiana unless you have a brick and mortar business in Indiana. And the Seventh Circuit said, no, you can't do that. But the one that was upheld, they said, you can't ship wine to Indiana unless the customer has been to your winery in person and presented their ID in person so you could check that they were over 21. That is, a burden on both Indiana wineries and California wineries, but of course, California wineries are farther away. And the court said, well, that's just sort of a disparate impact, so that's okay.
What would you expect from Hoosiers?
Yeah, but you don't care about interstate pork. You can get good pork anyway, so you don't. You have no stake in this.
Yeah, well, now I don't even want it. I mean, like, there's some pretty graphic stuff about how pigs are kept. And it's just like, even the pork brief is like more graphic than I really felt comfortable with. Talking about how like one pig gets like sliced up and like sent 20 different ways all over, you know, it's just like,
yeah.
So I read the briefs. I read the main briefs in the case. And I think you did as well. So I read the petitioner's brief, the blue brief, you know, for the pork council. Like it was kind of like weirdly kind of like law free. Like it kind of started with like talked about the, like the big cases, but it didn't really, I didn't think it like kind of built up the doctrine from first principles and like sort of made more just kind of like practical economic arguments.
I think that's fair. I mean, I think that is partly to their credit. I think that's partly kind of following the court's lead. Like if you read the cases, it's not like they have a lot of law or explain where they're coming from either. So, yeah, you know, maybe
but,
this
but
is
the to signal the extent that there are new justices and you're trying to get them on board for.
Yeah. I do think this is unsatisfying. I think part of the reason it's unsatisfying is like there's this sort of deep intuition as a matter of first principles that, of course, there's some sort of territoriality between California and other states. And like, of course, California can't just like directly like announce here's the new law of Iowa. But why that's true and what it has to do with the Dormant Commerce Clause is already kind of weird.
Yeah.
And then.
Yeah, because it seems like California shouldn't be able to do that, whether it's a commerce regulation or anything else, right?
Right.
Like they shouldn't be able to like, you know, punish assaults that occur in Iowa involving Iowans with no nexus to California, right?
Right. Exactly. And so this is part of the problem. And so that's the other thing about the ideological stakes of this case, by the way, is that the other extraterritoriality issue that the Supreme Court has heard of recently and must know is out there in the world is the abortion extraterritoriality issue.
Yeah.
Where the politics are the opposite, where California's power over Iowa would become Texas's power over Illinois and everybody would be on the other side. Yeah. So it's kind of nice that they have to consider it here, you know, and then presumably they'll be stuck there.
What this law it doesn't do is it doesn't say it's a crime to, you know, drive to Nevada and eat pork there.
Sure.
And it doesn't say it's a crime to like give people money to drive to Nevada and eat pork there.
Sure.
I mean, sort of what it's, you know, it's saying that like pork that was made in this way, you just can't sell here.
Right.
And so it's much less extraterritorial than some things that we could be talking about.
Although again, so that's the weird thing about the law is that it, when you look at the pork, you know, crossing state lines, you can't even tell by looking at it or frankly, even by like any amount of scientific tests you could do on it, whether it's good pork or bad pork, legal pork or illegal pork. The only way you could know whether it's legal pork or illegal pork is to know where it came from. So like the obvious extrapolation of this, if California can do this, could they say nobody could ship any goods to California unless they are manufactured in the state that has abortion legal on demand? There's nothing to do with the good. Just say like, we want the goods to be made in certain states or states with certain rights and not others. That seems like it's obviously an attempt to extraterritorially import California's abortion laws. There's less of a, you know, maybe it's an extension from this case, but it raises the same kind of principle, which is why this one's a little bit.
It's definitely different, right? It's definitely different because it ties it specifically to the other state having certain kinds of laws. I mean, rather than saying like, you can only sell stuff that's been, you know, prepared in this way, right?
Right. Although, so maybe you could start with, you know, you have to pay your workers the California minimum wage. So you're prepared both cruelty free for the, not free, but reduced cruelty for the pork, reduced cruelty for the pork workers, so on.
Yeah. So, but you can imagine any number of other examples where it's like California just has, you know, some regulation on like the ingredients that can be in things labeled certain ways, like the ingredients that can be in, right, chocolate has to be, you know, 66%.
Yeah.
Some percentage cacao. And then it's like, well, all of a sudden, is that an extraterritorial application? Because people who are making chocolate in other states have to like make it to a certain specification. That doesn't seem right.
I think that's right. Or even just imagine California just says like, you can't sell pork in California at all.
Yeah.
I think there is litigation about a lot of states and maybe now the federal government have a ban on selling horse meat for consumption. That was another one of these California propositions, because Robert Redford really likes horses and spent a lot of money on a ballot proposition. I think there were dormant commerce clause challenges by the small horse eating
industry. Who are these people? Who would, you know, be shameless enough to bring that?
There's some cases about it.
Have you eaten horse?
Not to my knowledge. Not on purpose.
I have a little bit.
Really?
In Uzbekistan.
How was it?
It was not very good. You know, I wasn't like excited about it, but we were trying to go find a place that would serve plov, which is like the Uzbek pilaf dish, yeah. You know, with rice and meat. And, you know, we had some and it was really good, but then we went to another place and they served it, but they serve it with like horse sausage, which was not my favorite. Great.
But California could totally ban the consumption of horse.
Could even they criminally punish me for doing that in Uzbekistan?
No, but they could say you can't bring horse into California.
Yeah.
Just because nobody could serve horse in California. And yes, that will have the indirect effect of saying, stop farming horses if you want to sell them in California. And that would be fine. So can I say one thing that irritated me about the briefs, befuddled me with the briefs more generally, including all the amicus briefs?
You read all the amicus briefs?
I word searched. I searched them.
There's like 50 on each side.
So this is not the first time this problem has come up in the law. So in the early 20th century, we had a lot of fights about the regulation of child labor and before that of prison labor, especially in the era when Southern states were using prison labor to basically evade the 13th Amendment. So there was like, you know, extensive sort of convict labor that looked a lot like slavery and lots of states were uncomfortable with it. And so there were questions about whether states could ban the importation of goods made using prison labor. Which I think is a much closer analogy in the sense that, like, again, you look at the good, it's not like the good has a certain amount of cacao in it. Like the chair is the same chair, regardless of how it was made. But there's something about the way the good was made that makes the state disapprove of it and not want it to be for sale in that state. That's sort of a regulation of what happens in the other state. And so there are cases about this. Most famously, Kentucky Whip and Collar versus Illinois Central Railroad Company and Whitfield versus Ohio. It's a complicated setting because there were some federal statutes enacted, like when the states were doing this, there were questions whether they could do it. So Congress enacted a statute clearly saying they could do it, which is exactly what the Dormant Commerce Clause sort of asks Congress to do, is to, if you want to allow states to regulate interstate commerce, you should pass legislation. But in one of the cases, Whitfield versus Ohio, the court talks about the specific question of whether or not the state of Ohio can ban the sale of convict-made goods in Ohio based on the fact that they were made, how they were made in Alabama. It says, yes, it could, as long, except unless they were in the original package, in which case it couldn't, but then Congress regulates it, so the original package comes in. These cases are not cited, so I shepherdized them. The cases are not cited in any brief in the case at all. None of these, like, historians who are supposed to help the court in context, like,
that's, you know, bizarre. So why? You're the only person who knows these cases? How do you know these cases?
I found them because I wanted to see how the court treated the earlier era. I just, you know, typed, you know, whatever, child labor and import and the right words into. So I started following the thread because when Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act regulating child labor, they dealt with this problem. And so I like just spent 10 minutes reading about it and just, you know, remembered the convict labor problem. And so I went back and looked at it. And Kentucky Whip and Collar is like extensively cited in Congress as they're debating with the Dormant Commerce Clause principles. Now, maybe the problem is nobody wants to cite them because it's actually not clear who they help. Like, because they come from a slightly different context and we don't have the original package doctrine anymore. Like, if you actually wanted to think through it, it's not like...
Commerce Clause cases?
They're Commerce and Dormant Commerce Clause cases, because they both have to deal with what's the state power and then what happens when Congress steps in and, you know, to what, how do they all work together? So I think if you've sent these cases, you know, maybe if you're an associate who found these cases for the National Pork Producers, they'd be like, I'm not sure if that helps us. Let's stick to our economic theory. But you'd think there'd be some...
Yeah, there's a lot of briefs in this case. That is weird.
Yeah. So hopefully some Gorsuch clerk has found them.
Now.
Seems like somebody ought to look at them. And again, this is like a major episode in American history. So it's a little weird that we're acting like it is a totally new problem, except that we never really solved it. I mean, in that sense, it's like alcohol, right? Where we had tons of interstate commerce debates like this over alcohol. We had all these cases about, like, you know, can you stop them from shipping the alcohol through your state? Well, what if the train, you know, moves it from one to another? What if it's in the original package? What if you break the bulk? The cases were just a mess. And then we, you know, did prohibition and undid it. So we just never really figured it out. But I think that's the world we're in again. I think, you know, pork is the new alcohol.
I guess so. Okay. So talking about the briefs a little bit more, some interesting things going here. So I liked one of the briefs, I think a bit more maybe than you did.
Yeah.
Because it said you sort of found them all not helpful.
Yeah. You try to sell me on this.
I liked this brief by the Humane Society, which is, they were the interveners below. And so they're one of the respondents, in addition to the state of California is also a respondent. So we have two red respondent briefs in this case. But this one was filed by a set of people. You know, the most well-known in terms of Supreme Court litigation, I think, is Jeff Lampkin of Molo Lampkin in D.C., but the counsel record is Bruce Wagman of Riley Safer Homes and Canchilla LLP in San Francisco.
Which of them's going to argue?
I don't know. I haven't looked at the hearing list. Maybe we can look at that in a second. I thought this was a strong brief. It had a lot of kind of sharp language and nothing that I thought went over, nothing that crossed an important line, as we say, in the business. But I thought it really called out a bunch of the arguments that the petitioners were making and the petitioners making and sort of showed how they don't make sense or how they like lead to crazy results. And I thought it did a few things well. So one is it at least gestured towards building things up from first principles. It did more in terms of history. You know, you might not have liked the history, but at least tried there. And then it did a lot of engaging with academic writing. Mm-hmm. Like it cited like a dozen, two dozen law review articles by really smart people.
Cited, well, you like that?
No, I mean, I don't. I'd rather them cite law review articles by dumb people like me. But I do like it when they try. And also, you know, I just thought hit back in some ways that were kind of strategically smart. Like the petitioner, kind of the pork people, try to sort of paint this law as kind of dumb because it's like regulating other states based on like moral objections, right, rather than like economic, which are the only thing that matter. And this brief did a good job of being like, well, look, look at like every world religion has regulated like food consumption and like the way in which like meat is processed and consumed, which I thought was nicely done because it's obviously going to appeal to the kind of more religious liberty kind of focused justices, at least, you know, kind of atmospherically. So I thought it was a really good brief. What was missing other than Kentucky whip and collar?
Well, I feel like it's very negative. If you think you win the case, and obviously they are the respondents, right? So if you win the case by just shooting down the petitioner's theory, showing like, okay, they have a theory of how you should strike this down, but...
And the posture in the case is the suit has been, you know, dismissed at an early stage, and the question is whether it should be allowed to go forward.
Right. If you think that you're in the district court or something, or you're just trying to say, like, okay, they've got a theory of the case, and their theory of the case doesn't work, so we should win, I kind of get that. But if you think it's like the Supreme Court is confronting a kind of long-running problem that it knows is going to come up again, and so you kind of need to sell them on a theory, even a negative theory, so that they know that ruling for you isn't going to lead to weird results later. Like, I mean, the other place this comes up a lot is the internet, and to what extent can states regulate things on the internet, which often have the same kind of extraterritoriality problem where, like, technically I'm only regulating the receipt of tweets in Texas, but has an obvious effect on the sending of tweets other places. And I think the court is smart enough to know that's a problem and to need, like, not just to know that the petitioner's brief doesn't work, but to have a theory of how they should think about this.
Yeah, I thought it did some of that in that it just tried to paint all the cases as being about kind of protectionism and discrimination. And I think that does. Well,
so as you understand it, can California ban Twitter in California?
Could they ban people from using it?
Yeah, or even ban the sending of tweets to California, ban the importation of tweets to California.
Putting aside all the First Amendment stuff.
Sure, yeah.
Right. I don't see why not, right? If they could ban pork altogether, why couldn't they ban?
Yeah. And then like, doesn't that make it really hard to run Twitter? You don't even know where your users are necessarily.
It could be, but there's lots of things that are hard and...
Fine, but that seems like a problem for their position.
I
mean,
I guess the question, there's different questions there, though. Could they make it illegal to use Twitter? And then who can they enforce that against, right? So could they punish Twitter for just like having their service...
Right.
That is accessed by people in California, or do they have to focus their enforcement efforts on users in California?
But I mean, so, you know, personal interest, California regularly lets you sue out-of-state manufacturers for sending things into California impermissibly. So you get personal jurisdiction, like International Shoe is literally about this, right? That's Washington. But so presumably California could allow civil lawsuits against, I mean, Twitter's in California, so maybe I need to make it Texas.
But then they'd have to potentially get that enforced in other jurisdictions. I mean, California... Yeah. Twitter is a California-based company, so they'd have to like flee to Texas.
Have Texas ban Twitter. It's more likely, right?
And mandate people use Truth Social.
I guess what I mean is, like, this is the obvious can of worms you open by rejecting any kind of extraterritoriality or any strong extraterritoriality doctrine under the Dormer Commerce Clause. I think probably that's the right answer, but I wouldn't be, if I were on the court, I wouldn't be satisfied until I had a general story about this. Another option that friend of the show, Jack Goldsmith, has written about, I think he and Eugene Volokh have a pending article in the Dormer Commerce Clause. He has another article on court case that people should read. So maybe we'd say, look, actually, Twitter can figure out where you are because the internet is very good at geolocation. So it's not that hard for Twitter to press a button saying, like, no tweets to Texas, and that would work. But
I mean, people can get around that with VPNs and things.
Right. But maybe that would be the rule, is like, as long as
it's a reasonable effort or something.
Yeah. Something that the sender can comply with, that's okay.
Yeah.
But it's just these quickly get, I mean, and it's good lawyering.
Those seem more like practical issues than issues that should control what the power of the state is. I don't know. I agree that,
like a true formalist.
Yeah, no, but I just agree that it's like, it would be messy. It's hard to know exactly how to operationalize it if a state wants to ban certain kinds of internet content from reaching its users in the state. But that's a separate question of how exactly it's going to work and like when it's appropriate, who it's appropriate to, you know, put those burdens on.
Yeah.
Is different from.
Maybe we're on the same page. But that's the thing I find unsatisfying so far about the briefs. And that's the kind of thing that hopefully gets hashed out at oral argument. When you have the respondents at brief, you obviously don't want to say, now look, let me anticipate for you a bunch of like tough hypos you're going to give us, and let me give you our best answers. And obviously, maybe you can just say, yep, like state regulation of the internet's going to be a mess until Congress preempts it. Or maybe you have something else to say. But
and Jeff Lampkin is arguing for the Humane Society, okay, by the way. So he's going to do a good job.
They get divided argument?
Yes. So there's actually four advocates in the case, because this is something I want to talk about next. But we've got petitioners, and then you've got Ed Kneedler on behalf of the Department of Justice as amicus curiae on one side, and then we have two respondents. We have Michael Mongan, who's the California SG, and Jeff Lampkin. Sometimes when there's like multiple parties, the court like makes them pick. But I think when it's a state and then a private party, it doesn't work that way, and both get to argue.
That's interesting.
I'm not sure, but sometimes it's just, they just say like you have to pick, or we're going to pick, and you can't have divided argument between two different parties.
Right.
So, but yeah, that flags for me the other thing I was going to ask is like the SG's office is on the side of pork.
Yeah.
And I don't totally know why. I mean, I don't really know why, like, I'm not saying I think they should clearly be on the other side, but I don't totally know why, you know, what the considerations are that led them to go in one direction versus the other. What do you think?
Well, so interesting, they're on the side of pork, but they're not on the side of extraterritoriality. So they have, and this is like a classic, there's like an old genre of SG's briefs, right, where it's like a complicated case, and we come in with like either a middle path or path that's sort of a more modest way to get there. In this sense, are agreeing with the Lampkin brief that we shouldn't think of this as an extraterritoriality case. This is a normal case. But they also don't want to concede, sort of open up the can of worms to the full California effect. So they want to decide all of this under a balancing test. A balancing test they did not invent, a balancing test that the Supreme Court articulated once in a case called Pike, that's sort of usually sort of like the rational basis test of Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine. Like in theory, you ask, does the state have a sufficiently good reason for doing this, given the burden of commerce? But in practice, you almost always lose these cases when you're challenging the law. And maybe that suits the federal interest in the sense that they don't necessarily want to dramatically change what the states can do, open up a sort of whole new can of worms. But they also want to have a way to say when the states regulate the internet in some way that really bothers them, like, this just goes too far. And they're pretty happy having the federal courts just get to kind of exercise the, like, this goes too far button.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the greater the scope of the Dormant Commerce Clause, the greater federal authority is, right? Because the states can't do as much, and
yeah,
Congress can let them do it or not if it wants to.
Yeah. And because this is another like SG move, I think it takes advantage of the procedural posture of the case, right? This is still at the motion to dismiss stage. So I think their position in the brief is, there is a balancing test. Petitioners plausibly allege that the law fails the balancing test. So I take it they could still reserve the right to later come in this case and even uphold the law to say, like, you know, yeah, we should at least let the district court find out how bad is this going to be for Iowa and how good is it going to be for California. So I could see that being attractive to some of the justices. Methodologically, it's a tough sell, I think, for a lot of the more conservative justices, because this is sort of the least easy to justify part of the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine.
Just this, because it's kind of a fuzzy balancing test.
Right. Yeah, it's one thing to say there's a line or that states can't discriminate, but to just say, like, federal courts should decide which state laws have a sufficiently good purpose in light of their other effects. I mean, that sounds like Lochner.
Yeah, yeah.
But good Lochner, not bad Lochner.
So yeah, I looked quickly at some of the amicus briefs, try to see if there was anything in there that could help me understand it. There was kind of an interesting one. So I found interesting this brief of professors Michael Knoll and Ruth Mason as amici curiae supporting petitioners, because they offered a slightly different way of thinking about these cases. So, and their argument is what matters is whether, in looking at the cases, is whether the law in question is internally inconsistent, which means in this context, what it means is, does the state law do something such that if every state, they actually reference the Kantian categorical imperative in the brief, if every state did it, there would be like conflicting regulation. And so they say yes, because California is regulating the production of pork in its state, but also sale, which has implications for the production of pork elsewhere. And if like everybody did that, there would be these conflicting regulations where you're regulating the state one is regulating the pork in its production of pork in its state, but also state two is regulating the pork of production in its state. And so that's the problem and that's the key. And this sort of made sense to me, but then like I got a little deeper into it and they sort of said, look, any given state can choose one or the other. It can regulate production or sale. But then I think you still end up with the like conflict problem, because like if state one can choose to regulate either production or sale, and it regulates sale and therefore indirectly regulates production in the other state, and then the other state chooses to regulate production, don't you still have the same problem?
You do. It's a Kantian theory, not like a practical theory.
Yeah.
And you could think of it as at least like, so this comes from how the court deals with some of the taxation cases. There's a, and they derive this from the interstate taxation cases, maybe you said that you could think of this as at least like an outside limit. You definitely shouldn't let a state adopt a method of regulation that wouldn't work if everybody did it.
Yeah.
Now, what do you do if there are two choices and either one would work if everybody did it, but right now some states do it one way and some states do it the other way? This method seems to say, like, well, that's going to be messy, but at least like the states are kind of doing something principled. Like it's not their fault that other states aren't doing it the right way. I guess the idea is like then at least that we're in the realm where you could imagine the states could eventually kind of coordinate on the right way to do it or negotiate. But I agree, it's a little unsatisfying.
Yeah.
It also has a deeper connection to the extraterritoriality thing, too, in the sense that, like, back at, like, under the classical legal tradition or the principles of natural law or whatever, there are kind of two different theories for how states regulate, one of which is very territorial. It's like states regulate within their borders. Whoever's in their borders, they regulate that. Yeah. And the other one of which is very citizenship-based. States regulate their people, wherever their people are. And both of those pass the sort of internal inconsistency test. But of course, some, you know, traditions and jurisdictions focus more on one and some focus more on the other. And so you end up with inconsistencies. So I guess I find it similarly unsatisfying.
Yeah.
But again, this is the court's fault. It's not their fault. They're trying. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. We could keep going on this. I don't know if we've made any progress.
Well, so can we do at least a prediction? If we don't know what should happen, do we know what will happen?
My guess is the California law will be upheld.
Really?
You think it's going to be struck down?
I'm not saying that yet, but I'm just wondering how you count to five.
Well, I mean, so let's start off with, we've got a couple justices who are deep skeptics of this doctrine.
Yeah. Generally, let's give Thomas and Gorsuch to California.
Then you've got to at least think, you know, there's a decent chance of getting some number of the liberal justices, right?
Because they like...
You said that's the, ideologically, that's the framing.
Yeah, okay.
At least some chance, maybe not. And then, I don't know, it's not so ideological that it's clearly all the others are going to be in favor of pork. Like, there's some decent arguments here. And I just thought that the slippery slope arguments were a lot harder for the petitioner, because the petitioner basically just says, like, something violates the Dormant Commerce Clause if, like, it has a big economic impact on other states. And that can't be right.
I mean, it can be if it's big enough. That's the That's the Pike theory. I mean, my gut instinct is that you're right, but the fact that the court granted the case at all makes me think they'll probably,
yes.
Especially because this is not like, yeah. This is not like an area where the circuit split is so sharp that the court really had to step in. This is an area, there've been a bunch of petitions raising this kind of question for gasoline and ethanol. And so something must've caused them to think, okay, now this is the one worth taking and getting into. Now, sometimes that's four people in search of a dream. Sometimes it's just like, okay, let's take the case. Seems like an interesting problem or whatever. But that makes me kind of second guess my gut instinct and think like, maybe we're going to just get some weird fractured 7-2 balancing test thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, ideologically, like, I'm sure some of the conservatives don't like this idea that California just gets to set policy for the whole country.
Right.
Which I don't really like either. I mean, I think California is like too trigger happy with regulation.
Right. And if you're at the Supreme Court, maybe you think like, look, it's our slippery slope. So we can always, we can say something and we can stop it from going all the way down.
You know, maybe they just really like cheap pork. I don't know.
I don't think anyone living in California. Well, I guess they care about, importing from somewhere else. Yeah. Yeah. I think this is tricky. Both what the answer should be and which is part of the reason I wanted to talk about it, even if our analysis is kind of unsatisfying.
It's one where I feel like I spent a couple hours reading stuff. I feel like this would take me like a week of going back and reading all the cases and thinking about it and to get to a place where I like really understood what was going on. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to do that. Maybe someday I will do that if I like write an article about this area of law, but I'm not there yet.
Maybe my hope, which I don't predict at all, is that this will maybe cause the court to resurrect the original package doctrine, which is, what it used back in those old cases I was complaining about the court ignoring, which on the one hand was sort of totally ridiculous and proved unworkable, but was a kind of one of the best legal fictions of the early 20th century.
And how would that apply here?
I think then California would be able to regulate the pork. Basically, you could ship the pork from Iowa to California, but then at some point, once it entered the stream of commerce in California, California could regulate it. So it might actually both, it would probably mostly be a de facto win for the state, but be a little more complicated.
All right. And so you are not making a prediction, or you're predicting that I'm wrong or what?
Yeah, I'm predicting that you're wrong. I guess if I have to make, I won't wimp out. I predict that the law is going to be struck down on unsatisfying grounds.
Yeah. Okay. That seems, I didn't have a very strong view about it. Okay. So lots more happening this sitting. That's all we're going to talk about this time. We will maybe circle back if anything interesting happens in one of the other cases arguments, but got to keep it unpredictable. So that's where we're going to stop.
Thanks for listening. Thanks to the Constitutional Law Institute for sponsoring all of our endeavors. Thanks for the reviews and comments I've been leaving online or sending to us. And please keep listening to the show.
And remember, you can email us at pod@dividedargument.com, or you can call our voicemail line at 314-649-3790 and leave us a message. We do read and listen to all those. We're not great not responding, but we do pay attention to them, and we will occasionally play a voicemail on the show. Go to our website, dividedargument.com. We've got transcripts of the episodes that go up pretty shortly after the episodes air. Store.dividedargument.com. We've got some good merchandise. And if there's a long delay between this episode and our next one, it's because we've been subject to extraterritorial jurisdiction.
It's better than a bacon joke.